Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Spurs in full cry here.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name is Windy, and I'm joined by my psychic and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Good afternoon, Windy.
And our tactics guy and my sleeping beauty, Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
We're all gonna die.
Yeah. Gosh. It feels very trivial to be talking about football with everything that's happening in the world at the moment. And I hope that this is a distraction for some listeners. I don't want to sort of exactly what I've just said, trivialise what's going on. And, you know, we all have loved ones who would be high risk were they to contract this nasty virus that's sweeping the planet. So we very much appreciate that everyone is very on edge right now. And if we can provide some kind of distraction in the form of discussion of what's going wrong with Tottenham Hotspur, then that's a good thing. So what we're going to do, as we haven't podcasted for a while, we're going to talk through the Burnley game, we're going to talk through the RB Leipzig game, talk through how things are going with Tongi and Ndombele, because my gosh, there's a lot to say there. And then we're going to talk a little bit about how the coronavirus is affecting football. And I mean, like I said, obviously it's very trivial compared to the bigger picture, but this is a football podcast, so we've got to try and do that. We'll start off with Burnley then. It was an interesting team selection. We went with a 3-4-3. When Eric Dier's in the starting 11, I think there's always a part of you that wonders whether it'll be a back three or whether he'll be playing in defensive midfield. It was odd in some ways that we played a back three with essentially no midfield against Burnley, who like to play forward early up to Chris Wood and win second balls and knockdowns. They got the ball out to Dwight McNeil regularly, and he was beating his man and whipping in cross after cross after cross. And ultimately, we had to kind of give up on that formation at half time and make some changes. We'll come on to that. But Nathan, were you surprised with the 11 that started?
I definitely was when I read it, but I guess that it was largely forced by the injuries that we have at the moment and the fact that we were sort of rotating in preparation for the Leipzig game. But then I just think we know how Ndombele plays when he starts rather than when he comes off the bench. So we knew that we were going to be just completely surrendering midfield anyway, which I just think is not really a way you can ever set up. I know how incredibly cynical this is, but there's almost an element of like Jose is deliberately setting that up to say, see, this is what happens to prove a point, because like,
okay,
And not that I'm absolutely glued or certain of that idea, but it's just like, of course, we surrendered the midfield with Skippen and Ndombele there. The back three wasn't so shocking because I think we've seen that quite a bit over the last couple of weeks, and I feel like that is essentially how Mourinho decided that he wanted to set up for the second leg against Leipzig straight after the first leg, and then we've played that formation since as sort of preparation.
This feels like a very long time ago, this match, because so much has happened since. So like trying to think back to how I felt at the time of a team selection is tricky, but I know that in the lead up Mourinho had made a big thing about having to either focus on Burnley or on Leipzig, and he couldn't focus on both. I know that we'd just come off the match against Norwich and lots of players were knackered. Bergwijn is broken as a result of the Norwich game.
Yep.
Lucas was exhausted. Lo Celso was clearly hugely exhausted. We're essentially, players are in the red zone at this point. They're at risk of suffering muscular injuries. And so Mourinho had little choice but to do some rotation. I think a lot of people made assumptions that he'd essentially prioritise the Leipzig game. I'm not sure that's the case. I think he just picked the probably, as he saw it, most fit players or least at risk of picking up injuries players. Bardi, what did you make of a team selection and this performance against Burnley?
Had Ndombele played like the Ndombele we thought we were signing, then I think we would have been able to control the ball. But essentially, we came up against a very industrious team with a very unindustrial central midfield. And we weren't able to play the ball out. We weren't able to pick up the second ball. And we weren't able to do anything to really affect them. And it wasn't until we brought on Lo Celso, who's great at keeping the ball, and Lucas, who gives us an option on the counter-attack, and for all his faults, is a hard-working player who is capable of collecting the second ball. It wasn't until we made those changes that we saw a little bit of daylight. And I think had the game continued on and meandered on, I think we probably would have won it in the end. I think somebody would have come up with some touch of class to win it. But, you know, Burnley are a tough team, and it's a tough place to go for a reason. And a point at the end of the day, they were on a good run as well. They could have gone above us had we beaten them. A point is probably not too bad a result.
Yeah, I think that's fair. At any other points in recent seasons, you probably would have taken a point away at Burnley. But the situation we were in has led to this feeling like a really disappointing result. And I think the nature of the performance makes it so as well. And you're right to say that we improved in the second half, because that is absolutely the case. But we still didn't look a threat. And I felt all the time that Burnley had us at arm's length. And we were heavily reliant on getting a penalty to score. A penalty that was taken by Dele. It was a really good penalty. There was kind of a big sense of weight being lifted off Dele, I thought, in the celebration and the way he kind of took control of that situation. And actually, I was really pleased with how Dele spoke pre-Leipzig and post-Leipzig as well. He seemed to be taking on a lot of additional responsibility there and showed some real maturity. He had a good game against Burnley. I said that at half-time that he was playing well, and lots of people on Twitter disagreed with me. I thought he was one of few players who was willing to kind of bring the ball down under pressure and try and do some things, do the right things. It certainly didn't come off every time, but I was kind of pleased to see him take responsibility. Bardi, what did you make of Dele?
Dele, we know, is a fantastic player, but he's always kind of worked off somebody else, whether that be Kane, whether that be Eriksen or Son at moments. But those guys aren't there now. The desk front line is gone, and he remains. He is our established star now. He is our number one player. And we've kind of been looking towards him to step up and try to turn games on his own ability, instead of these fleeting moments where he arrives and scores a goal, to actually have an impact for a sustained period of time. And I think he's doing that. And against Burnley and against Leipzig, I really liked the way he was moving. I liked the things he was trying. But unfortunately, he is in actually a situation now where he is on his own and he doesn't have the players around him. Against Leipzig, we didn't have Bergwijn's speed and his ability. And unfortunately for Dele, he's now stepped up, but he's looked around and he's on his own. He needs some help.
I think that's a really, really astute point. He's not the kind of player that can do things on his own often. He works off others and is very reliant on others making space available for him and holding the ball up and having some neat interplay around the edge of the box. He's not someone who kind of just picks up the ball and pings it into the top corner like someone like Heung-min Son can. Nathan, what have you made of Dele?
I've been pretty impressed, you know, especially obviously I've sort of ragged on Lucas playing up top, but I do definitely think that Dele has performed well there. And the numbers match the eye test there as well. Yeah, so he put up like 0.9 expected goals in what game was it? Was it Wolves? And then had obviously the penalty, but you know we don't really look into that too much. And then he had our second best shot of the match, a 0.1 expected goal shot. So it's a tiny sample, but essentially he is getting. From that tiny sample, he was getting some decent shots in some decent locations, as well as being, you know, doing also what he does, coming deep and being involved in build-up play. So on that basis, there was some promise there. Obviously, now there's not going to be football for a long time, and it looks like we'll have Kane and Son back before the ball is pasted on the pitch again. But that, you know, that people had been calling for Dele to play up front for quite a while, and I feel like they were justified, and that he won't get his time to prove that was a smart call. Now
he's come up against a lot of criticism this season. He's had a really, really tough time, I think, Dele. Yeah. So last season, Dele was moved back into a deeper midfield position to compensate for the fact that we didn't have a defensive midfielder, and he wasn't at his best as a result. I felt he did a really good job of trying to do things, but he's not at his best in midfield anymore. He's much better in a final third. When Mourinho joined us, he put him in his best position. He shone for a couple of games, and then almost immediately the injuries hit and he was dragged back into that kind of deeper midfield position. And once again, I felt as though he was toiling away and you know, running as much as anyone, if not more than anyone, week to week to week. But we weren't seeing him his best, and it's taken a while for him to then be tried as a central striker. And like you say, he's kind of building a bit of a head of steam there. So whilst the team's underperforming, he's probably performing at a reasonable par level. The issue is that we need him to overperform to help us at the moment, and that's really difficult when key players are out around you. We should talk about the Leipzig game in some detail, I think. It was really upsetting because the first 10 minutes I thought went pretty well, and as ever with Spurs, you kind of had a bit of hope, and it's always the hope that kills you. Nathan, what did you make of the first 10?
Yeah, so watching live, the first 10 was really sort of exciting and promising, and then obviously everything fell apart. But I've been back and watched that opening section again. I sort of tweeted some still images and a thread on it, and basically it was never going to last. So we pressed Leipzig really intensely, really high up the pitch, but we did so in a sort of extremely man-orientated, almost man-marking style. And so for the first 10 minutes, we rushed them, we forced them into sloppy passes, we turned the ball over in midfield, and we attacked in behind really quickly. We got into the box two or three times early on, and that was really promising. And then sort of just before the 10-minute mark, Leipzig realised that they could simply beat their opposite number with a bit of skill or a bit of pace or a bit of power, and then they were free, because if you're marking a man and suddenly the opposition player on the ball is free, do you abandon your player? If you've not been instructed in that way, if that's not what the focus has been on in training, you're really lost. There's sort of a gamble within a heavy man marking or sort of a nearly man marking system, in that you're saying that you think that your players are as good or better than their opposite number. And this is a really strong Leipzig squad, young players but skillful and highly athletic. And I think that the way that we pressed them was doomed from the start. Maybe from one of those opening three chances, we could have got a goal and then sat back, but then we're still only level pegging overall. I don't know. It's confusing, but it doesn't look great under the lens.
I mean, I agree with a lot of what Nathan said in the first 10 minutes, but I think where we were different towards than Leipzig is when they started attacking man on man. We allowed them to get past, whereas when we did it, they would bring us down, and there was they committed nearly double the amount of fouls we did. They were much smarter. I think Winks, Lucas, Lamella, even Dele himself, they could have been a bit smarter with stopping the play with a tactical foul, whereas they beat us and then they let us go. We know referees are very unlikely to give a yellow card for a foul deep in the opposition's half. And I think that was where we just lacked smartness, which is weird considering Mourinho's our manager.
Mm.
They're really good, Leipzig. They're really, really good. And so it was no surprise that they beat us comfortably. It was just a shame that having done so well for that first 10 minutes that we couldn't just get the first goal, because I think that's what we were hoping for. That was the idea behind coming out and pressing them from the start. It was get that first goal and then see what happens. But of course, you know, it's Tottenham, so we throw one into our own net, essentially. I thought Winks was absolutely awful in the first half. I really felt for him watching that performance. You know, we've said for so long now that we lack a central defensive midfielder, so it feels pretty fruitless to say it all over again. But Winks was so exposed in this one with Sabitzer, who was just fantastic, running off him time and time and time again, and Winks not having no answer for it. They also completely dominated us on the flanks. Aurier is Aurier, and Sessegnon was just back after an injury layoff and looked so timid. He looked so short of confidence and just not the player we hope he will become at the moment. So we were struggling out wide, we're struggling in the middle, and we struggled with Lloris making poor errors. So I guess, you know, the end result is as a result of that. It's all those things coming together, and yeah, it just didn't go our way. Are there any positives to take from the game, Nathan?
At least Mourinho is keen on the idea of pressing high, even in big games occasionally.
Right, so Mittel, who is a long-time listener, says, is the Leipzig game finally evidence that Jose is willing to adapt his style, but we don't have the players to cope with teams countering on us when we do? I think that's a fair comment, actually. Bardi, do you think that's something perhaps we'll see more of next season?
Yeah, I think so. I can't remember when Nathan said this, but I think a lot of what's happening this season is Mourinho demonstrating weaknesses in the team and trying to highlight where the problems are. I would just like to reflect on Hugo. I think he's carrying an injury because he's, you know, he's not a bad goalkeeper. He doesn't normally let those two goals in. I think he's been rushed back from his injury because Vorm is pointless, and Gazzaniga has, and Mourinho's lost all faith in Gazzaniga.
Speaking of carrying an injury, we need to deal with the Tongi and Ndombele issue because we've not covered that yet. So I think there are two issues to discuss here, and that's firstly Ndombele's lack of effort, or certainly perceived lack of effort, and then secondly Mourinho's decision to call him out and what the purpose of that decision was. So on issue one, Neil Meppham, who is Mepfish on Twitter, he says, what did you think of Jamie Carragher's piece on Ndombele? Was it fair enough? So we'll start with that, Bardi. What did you make of Carragher's Monday Night Football bit on Ndombele? What did you make of Ndombele's performance in the first half against Burnley? And do you think it's a lack of effort, or do you think he's got an injury?
I mean, I think Tottenham, we have an issue anyway. When the ball goes into the fullback area, we never really have that kind of pass into midfield anyway. Ben Davies gave the ball away, I don't know, 20-something times against Chelsea, because when he gets pushed and pressed to the line, you need a midfielder coming short to collect it. And no one was doing it, and he wasn't, well, he was on the pitch actually against Chelsea. It wasn't happening then, and it's continued to happen. So I think there's definitely a question mark on that, on that willingness to drop into that area to help out a teammate. But also he suffers as well, because when you have a huge player this his size, always lack of effort is always pinned on them. As a tall footballer, you're always going to look a bit ungainly and a bit kind of slower than everybody else. So it's, you know, it's a fair stick to hit him with, but it's also unfair. But I'm going to go with Carragher and say he was right to whack him with this stick.
How about you, Nathan? Do you have any theories on this issue? Was this game different to... Because we previously defended him, didn't we, in the video against Wolves with Neto. Do you think this was different?
In that it was worse. It's not really a change of circumstances. We know what's been going on. I'm sympathetic to the idea that he's just absurdly lazy, and he does have sort of history in that area in the past, but like I don't find that satisfying as an answer. I don't think that, you know, you move to a top Premier League club having worked really hard all, you know, for 2 years to get that move, and then suddenly what, you rest on your laurels, you're happy with your contract, or maybe you just don't like Mourinho. I find that difficult as an explanation, and I think that the amount of time that he's spent out with injury this season, the repetition of the same injuries, to me that says there's a fitness issue, there's a sort of a soft lingering injury issue, and on that basis to, if that is the case, and certainly if Mourinho knows that's the case, the idea of calling him out in public is disgraceful, basically. It's really strange. I'm really struggling to come to terms with watching him sort of just plod around the pitch or shy away from the ball, because neither of these explanations make a huge amount of sense. But for Carragher or whoever to simply say he's lazy, he's disgraceful, is not like a full investigation and not a full consideration of what's going on.
Yeah, no, I think that's the key point. So here's where I stand on this. I think if Mourinho's been told by his backroom staff that Ndombele is fully fit now, we've had this fitness program for him, we've got him to a point where all the tests show that he's up to speed and he should be able to play and we should be able to start him, and then he puts out that performance where he seems not only demotivated, but like almost genuinely throwing the towel in, then I absolutely understand why Mourinho is furious at the performance. He's letting his team down. He really is letting his team down. But, and this is the bit where I'm really struggling with Mourinho's approach. What does he think he's going to get from doing this? And I think this is where we need to move to Mourinho's decision to call him out so publicly. Some people have said that they've listened back to it and what Mourinho said was not that bad and it was absolutely spot on. So point one, yes, it isn't that bad if you assume that Ndombele is not injured. It is absolutely not that bad. However, it's not that bad to think it, but to say it publicly in such a way. I mean, he started it off by almost saying, I can't say what I want to say because it's too bad. And then he just said it anyway.
He loves to do and that. That's one of his favourites.
He does. It's like a little teaser. I think personally that that's the end of Ndombele at Spurs. I think it's the beginning of the end, and this is a player we've broken our transfer record on. You know, I struggle to see how he can come back from this. It must have been so humiliating for him. And if Mourinho has some kind of insight into his character that says if you humiliate this boy a little bit, he's going to respond, and if that happens, then I will apologize and say, you know, you were right, I was wrong. I cannot see how that will happen. I just, as someone who manages multiple people and has managed multiple people over the last 10 years, I don't think public humiliation is an appropriate way of motivating the majority of human beings. And I really struggle with it. Bardi, what did you make of Mourinho's post-match stance?
Whenever a manager goes after a player, it very rarely ends well. I don't think this will end well. I think the next time we go to break our transfer record, we should do like what we did with Jimmy Greaves when we signed him for £99,999. Just go £1 underneath the record transfer, because every single player we've broken our transfer record for has been pretty bad. You know, Rebrov, Lamela, Ndombele, perhaps even Davinson. People would go at Davinson as well. So I think we should think twice before we break our transfer record again. I don't know whether this is the end of Ndombele. I think we need to see what happens over the next 6 weeks of this season, and then the summer, and then leading into next year. We know he needs a defensive midfield partner, but can we trust building our team around him? I think he's got another season in him, and I hope we see something from him, because we had a lot of faith. There was a lot of excitement around him. I just hope he doesn't become another record transfer flop.
I hope you're right. He's so talented. He's so talented. Nathan, the most pundits have been in universal agreement that what Mourinho did was not a good thing in terms of remotivating that player. Do you have any kind of hope that that approach could work?
I guess footballers are kind of different, and Mourinho does sort of have a lot of experience. Maybe he's always got it wrong, but like he did certainly at least used to be noted as a man manager. He's not the only manager to criticise a player in public. So footballers are pretty weird. But essentially the idea here is that like he's tried being nice, which firstly I'm not that convinced of, but he's tried holding back and now he's giving him both barrels. And it's like, okay, just because being nice hasn't worked so far doesn't mean that it's not going to be fruitful eventually, and then that doesn't account for the potential negative effects of calling him out in public. So that's not like a complete logical thing either. And in terms of pundits, it's like there's this very obvious parallel here, isn't there, with Paul Pogba, you know, another incredibly talented French black midfielder that Mourinho gave all kinds of criticism again and again and again in public interviews, and I think did a lot of damage there to his United career, Mourinho's United career, and I feel like pundits are learning from that and saying maybe you should respect your players more.
And this is the other thing: people are queuing up to take shots at Mourinho in the media. They really are. He is the polar opposite to Pochettino in many ways, in that he's not well liked in most media outlets. So to do something as kind of controversial and shocking as this just makes him an easy target. He's making his life even more difficult. It's bizarre to me. I don't understand this approach in particular. I think if he wanted to be that scathing, he should have done it out of the public eye.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
But a question from Rally Gersling, who says, what's the deal with footballers struggling with fitness? Do they just not train too hard to preserve the quality of the technical training? Nathan, I feel like you'll be a good person to respond on this. Mm. We've had so many injuries, and I've kind of been taking a few slightly sort of facetious shots on Twitter about Pochettino's role in all this. What do you think is causing all these injuries we've had?
I mean, something clearly went wrong with our fitness this season from the off. I don't know whether it's likely to be that either we tried to front load our physical activity too hard at the beginning of pre-season, or started too soft and tried to build up too slow from the beginning of the season. I'm not sure which is. I guess the rate of injuries would say that we started too slow. I don't know, whatever, but there was clearly some sort of gamble and miscalculation on, or I get the impression that there was some sort of gambling and miscalculating on behalf of sort of Pochettino and Perez, and that sort of undid Pochettino's time at the club and also left Mourinho in a really bad spot as well, because there's just this simultaneous fatigue, like a lack of freshness and a lack of match fitness just throughout the squad all season. There's a differing of styles here as well, in that Pochettino wants to sort of get the absolute maximum out of all of his players on a season by season basis, and that sort of does run players into the ground earlier in their careers, which means they peak earlier and have shorter careers, but means that they play a similar number of matches just by being able to play week in, week out. Whereas Mourinho doesn't want to like push them up to the red line again and again and again. He's happy to just sort of maintain a more steady level of fitness without like as drastic peaks and troughs, and rotate more and not absolutely push for every minute of every game. So I guess that sort of the changing approach to periodization between the two managers probably undermines the fitness as well. I don't know, it's really weird. Something clearly has gone wrong in terms of the physical preparation for this season, and it's something that we're still very much not over at all.
Mm. It's interesting that you mentioned pre-season, actually, because thinking back now, even in pre-season we had loads of injuries to the point where a lot of players couldn't go on the tour, and we ended up taking a lot of youth players and having to play them out of position just to sort of fill gaps in the team.
Okay.
And even within that tour, we were playing players more than we wanted to because there were so few available. Mm. And I remember that being an issue. I remember not being too worried about it at the time because I thought, okay, well, the players that will come back will then kind of be fresh and they'll be joining at a time when we'll need that freshness. And it really hasn't worked out that way. And Bardi, of course, he's also had the issue that because there's been so many injuries, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy because he's having to play the likes of Lucas and Bergvin over and over again. Do you have sympathy, Bardi, for Mourinho with this?
Yeah, I think Nathan touched on something there where we've gone from one manager who has one style of getting people fit and how they approach the season and then switching straight away to another one. I think the lack of rotations hurt us. I think as weird as it is, I think lacking Moussa Sissoko as well has hurt us because there's an individual that normally can complete 90 minutes after 90 minutes after 90 minutes and he's able to take a lot of strain off other players. I think it's one of those things. I think there's a combination of the way we came out of the World Cup last season. The season before? I'm losing my mind now of all the seasons. But how we came out of the World Cup with no pre-season, no signings. And it just seems to have been a continuation of bad planning. And I think a lot of this can probably be attributed to that summer where we signed nobody and we had 11 players at the final week of the World Cup.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're quite right. The lack of signings, the lack of rotation under Pochettino at times. He only really rotated the fullbacks regularly. There wasn't other regular rotation throughout his whole tenure at Spurs.
Mm.
The lack of involvement of youth players, meaning you're not kind of resting key players at key times. The Bielsa burnout effect. You know, we went for this high pressing style for at least, I'd say, 3 of his 5 years. There are many reasons why that could have led us to the position we're in now. And it's just like everything's hit at once and it's really unfortunate. And I feel lots of people are kind of looking back now and saying, well, obviously we should have signed a striker in January. And I kind of think, yeah, that's easy to say now. But in January, we had Son and we signed Bergvin, who we thought could potentially help with some minutes up front, or certainly in the final third and chip in with goals and allow us to play Son up front. So I don't know. I would not have been happy if we'd signed Odion Ighalo or, dare I say, the like someone of the ilk of Chris Wood. I'd have been really disappointed with that kind of short-termist approach. So I think it's wrong to say that we should have signed a striker. But you just the luck is just insane with Kane going down and then Son, or like the week after the transfer window closed, him succumbing to injury as well.
Well, we did speak about it at the time when the transfer window closed, and it was always a gamble. And it was a gamble that we took, and it has backfired. I think had we a Chris Wood, a English Llorente, I think we'd probably be getting better results. Maybe Piontek was wrong, but maybe we should have gone for a Kane alternative in like a giant lump. Ighalo, I don't know. There's moments where you kind of glimpse at Ighalo and he looks better than Lucas Moura as in number 9 position. And I think that's maybe where we've lacked something. Lucas Moura can't play through the middle. Ighalo, for his weakness in his game, can. Same with Chris Wood. So maybe there was a case that we should have loaned Ighalo.
I appreciate what you're saying completely. And I think we did try for the short-term option. We tried to get Willian Jose on loan. We tried to get Olivier Giroud on loan. They didn't come off. So they obviously had like players in mind that if they were available on loan, Piontek we tried to get on loan. If they could have got that kind of ilk of player on loan, I think they'd have been happy. But if that's not available and you're going to have to sign someone over 2-3 years, you don't want someone that isn't right for the squad long term. And so I kind of accept the fact that they didn't sign someone. I think it's a reasonable approach to assume that we can go with Son and then use Dele and Bergvin and Lucas and Lamela and whoever in the final third. I think that is fine, and it's just so unfortunate that, like I said, Son got injured like the week after. Nathan, am I letting him off the hook too easily here?
I would have signed a defensive midfielder.
yeah, there's that. Yeah, no, that's a very fair point. And I guess the other thing is, of course, that the ideal approach is that you have lots of players lined up who you've scouted through analytics and scouting leagues that are kind of under the radar, and you have backup options for when Olivier Giroud is not possible to sign. This is the constant frustration with Spurs, and was one of my frustrations with Pochettino at the helm as well. Okay, right, we'll come back to transfers because we've got questions on those, but we're going to talk talk about coronavirus. Obviously, this is far bigger an issue than just football, but we're going to talk about how it affects the rest of the football season. So Big White Heart Lane Blue Heart, who is at Spurs Last Minute on Twitter, he says, regarding COVID-19, what do you think is the most likely course of action for the league and Champions League remainder? Will it be void? Will it restart through the summer or something else like playoffs? Basically, what will happen to us with games to go and no end outcome? Buddy, I mean, at this point, it's very difficult to predict what might happen, but what do you suspect they'll be thinking of as possible solutions here?
I mean, I don't think football can continue behind closed doors, because as human beings in general, we're too stupid to be able to do that. The whole point of football behind closed doors is to stop people gathering. And as PSG and Valencia showed last week, if a football match takes place, people will gather. If we continue the season behind closed doors, and Liverpool, when Liverpool win the league, there will be thousands upon thousands of Liverpool fans on the streets celebrating. So the whole purpose of limiting gatherings isn't going to happen. I think the only way is, let's get through to April. Let's see what the situation is with the virus and the numbers and everything else, and then make a decision to probably not void the league. I think they will take into account final positions, and then they will probably, in my opinion, probably promote the top two teams in each division up a level and do no relegation. I think that's probably the only way to get through it. Liverpool crowned champions with an asterisk next to their name, which will annoy them forever. But I think that's probably how it's going to go. And European places will go to those teams who are in the European places if there is a Champions League next year.
So I'm thinking the opposite. I'm thinking that they'll try and finish the league in some way. And I don't know how that will work timing wise. Like, could they wait and see what happens? Wait for a point where the majority of people have either had the virus and become immune, or the numbers are so low that it's kind of the spread's stopping a little bit, and then start having some behind closed doors matches just to get the season done. That could then run into the start of next season. You could push next season back. We've already moved the Euros, so that gives capacity to do that kind of thing, to run late, and then perhaps next season starts late, and then there's a knock-on effect there. Nathan, how about you? What do you think would be kind of a practical solution? What do you foresee happening?
I'm obviously not a medical expert in any kind of way, and I've not done any studying of pandemics, but I am, like, obviously a nerdy guy who's into reading over the science and the graphs and everything, and I've really been putting my homework in on this, and this is, like, not going to be over in a few weeks. Like, this is going to go on for 6-9 months, a year. So, like, we're not just going to postpone this season and come back to it at a later time, that's for sure. So we need to make decisions about results. Obviously, you know, situations where Liverpool have run away with the league, they've won the league, but the Champions League, you're not going to get any kind of decisive winner. I don't think that we can continue to play football, like Barty says, behind closed doors, because, yeah, people, aside from chanting outside the stadium, will go to the pub to watch the game and nonsense like that. And I think that we will see gatherings of, like, more than five people ruled against, or at least highly, highly discouraged. So I just think it will be quite a while before we see football.
I think this is going to have a knock-on effect. I think Premier League clubs can deal with the fallout of not having live games, but I think there's going to be a massive knock-on effect down the leagues.
100%.
Especially, yeah, teams that are reliant on gate receipts, on match day income. It's going to hurt. Eventually, it will start to hurt the Premier League as well, because, you know, Tottenham needs that, what million pounds of beer that they get for each game. So this is a huge thing. I think the Euros will definitely goad us. They can always bring them back on, and we'll probably see a Premier League season maybe start later in the winter, September, October. And then Champions League, maybe European competition, cancelled for another year.
I tell you what, though, people are going to need football as a distraction. Mm. This is going to be a really miserable period, and for a lot of people, myself included, football is escapism. Football is a step away from your everyday life where you don't have to think about anything except your team's performance and results. and it's a very welcome distraction in a challenging modern world.
I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. What am I going to do with all my time, Windy? You know,
seriously, this is a huge issue. And again, like, that's not to trivialise the fact that thousands of people are going to be very unwell and are going to die. And that's insanely upsetting. And we're all going to know people who are affected by this. And it's horrible. It's almost impossible to contemplate how wide-reaching this is going to be. But this is why we need sport back, to give us some kind of distraction from this horror. And we had a question from Anthony, who says, I know it's not one of your normal topics of conversation, but do you think the club should help fans financially by refunding season ticket holders, putting the renewal date on hold, paying the match day staff regardless, etc.? And I thought that was a really kind of interesting question. Obviously, you're right to point out that there are some clubs who are not going to cope with this at all. Premier League clubs absolutely can. They have the kind of financial padding to allow that to happen. Nathan, what do you think Spurs will do? Are they going to help fans out? Are they going to pay their employees and make sure that people whose income is kind of, they need to work on match days in order to get paid? Do you think Spurs will help people like that out?
I certainly don't think that they will be keen to do so, but I think that I don't know if there will be, but there certainly should be government initiative, because loads and loads of major businesses, small businesses are going to collapse, but major businesses are going to be non-operational for a long time, which means millions of people essentially without work for a long time. So yeah, this is much bigger than football, in that there needs to be a dramatic financial restructuring all over industry, because there's going to be very little financial support for those in the most need. So I don't know if Tottenham will take any kind of initiative on it. We've seen a situation in America with a basketball team who the 19-year-old rookie player is given up one of his earliest professional paychecks to pay the sort of in-stadium staff rather than the owner, who's a billionaire. So, yeah, it's wild. So I don't know whether Levy and Lewis will take any kind of initiative on this, but I think that in order to avoid like a major global fallout, there will need to be like maybe even like a universal basic income in sort of a tax support method, because millions of people are going to be without income very soon.
I suspect there'll be some kind of Live Aid style crowdfunding charity event ultimately, which will help people, because it's going to get really bad before it gets any better. People are going to need a lot of financial support. Bardi, I'm interested, because you're a season ticket holder. How do you feel about this? Do you expect a refund from Spurs if the season gets cancelled?
I think we'll get a refund. I think Spurs will hang on to that money for as long as they can. Yep. They'll want to keep it in their bank account. There's also the weird, I mean, these aren't people on the breadline either, but an individual like Jan Vertonghen, whose contract is up, and then there's individuals who are further down the league who whose contracts will be up this summer. Then kind of what happens to them? I know they're not like, they're not going to be queuing up for food banks and everything else, but there's going to be thousands of footballers who will have no club this summer. And then it's still, I know it's a different level, but it's still a wage, it's still a job, it's still, they've got mortgages to pay on their own level. There's still going to be all these footballers out there who don't have jobs, and it's I'm hoping it doesn't end up this bad, because I don't know, I was feeling okay about it until Nathan just started talking, and now I'm like wow. I'm hoping it doesn't get that bad, but I don't expect Spurs to give me any money back anytime soon. They will wait until it's officially done, and I'm kind of glad I didn't renew my season ticket already, so I'm sure they'll let us extend that.
It's really interesting. So the problem, I suppose, with the solution I suggested, which is to just keep going until the season is done and then start the next one, is that it'll run over into the transfer window, and then you've got an issue as like, would you be allowed to play players you've just bought? How do you sign players from abroad if the restrictions are still there in terms of overseas travel? And there's all these kind of issues to get your head around. It's really going to change things. It'll be interesting to see that there might be some good to come from it. I mean, this is the thing. We've got to try and think of some nice things that might come from this global disaster. One of them I thought of this morning is that there's going to be some amazing art to come from this. People are going to have a lot of time. Writers will be writing novels and films and TV shows that are going to be, they'll have more time to dedicate to them. That's a good thing. This is going to be amazing. There's going to be some amazing art to come. Maybe young footballers will get more of an opportunity potentially, because like you say, Nathan, there might be some restrictions on players joining from abroad. And Jose Mourinho might be able to work out some tactics that benefit Spurs in this quiet period. And that leads on to a question from Oscar Anderson, who says, will the break actually help Spurs get to a better position because of injured players, or is it too late to hope for top five? I mean, it depends so much on whether the season restarts or not. But Bardi, are there positives for Spurs in this gap if it then starts up again? Say we do play behind closed doors to finish the season, would this be a positive?
Yeah, the more weeks we get, the closer Kane and Son get to returning. So yeah, that's probably the only positive. Other positives we can look towards is hopefully humans starting to be a bit nicer to each other. But yeah. I don't walk around any supermarket at the moment, and that's not the impression you get.
I think there's going to be a spike in the birth rate nine months after this period, because people are stuck at home with not much to do. That's going to be interesting. And more pressure on the NHS. Okay, right. This is a really long podcast already. So I think what we're going to do is call that part one, and we'll come back with part two. You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindner for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud, D. Lindner. Do check him out. He's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.